WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the White House came under attack from its former counterterrorism chief, Richard Clark, who had served in four administrations and who charged the Bush team with slighting the war on terror for the war in Iraq. Clark has gained some extraordinary name recognition. This week, a poll by the Pew Research Center for People and the Press found that nearly 9 in 10 of a little over 1,000 Americans surveyed said that they had heard of him. Of those polled, 42% said they'd heard a lot about his claims, and 47% said they had heard a little. Clark appeared on 60 Minutes, Charlie Rose, and Larry King, but most notably on the televised congressional proceeding of the 9/11 Commission, now investigating how the attacks of that day came to pass. Many Americans tuned in, but as United Press International editor Martin Walker told us, there was also an eager audience in Europe and the Middle East.
Well, the European and the Middle Eastern press have been fascinated by it. Al-Ahram, the Egyptian daily, was noting today that critics of the Bush administration have long said that it has had a credibility problem, particularly over the allegation of weapons of mass destruction. Now that credibility problem has been intensified with possibly dire effect for President Bush's hopes of re-election by the proceedings of the 9/11 Commission, and in particular by the claims of the former counterterrorism chief, Mr. Clark.
That hasn't been a great departure for that newspaper, though, has it?
It hasn't, no, but I think it pretty much sets the tone. Al-Ahram is in some ways the Times of the Arab world. It's the paper with a very long and distinguished history. But it was also interesting, I thought, that the way Le Monde put it today, they went straight into the political implications. They have a long article saying that Richard Clark has become public enemy number one for the White House. National security and what President Bush calls the war against terrorism are the sole area in which President Bush is judged favorably by the majority of Americans. On all other topics, from the economy to education, his side of the equation is lower than 50%. This is the context that explains the fury of the Bush team in their reactions to the statements that Mr. Clark has been making, because they see in them the possibility of Bush's strongest card being diluted.
What about the papers that have been traditionally the friends of the Bush administration in, say, Britain?
It's very, very striking that they have started to withdraw their support. The Spectator, which is a very conservative weekly in Britain, but a very influential one, says this: if Clark is right, then the so-called war on terror was no more than an excuse for an invasion that the Bush administration was determined to carry out in any case. Tony Blair becomes at best a mug, at worst, an accomplice to a massive deceit. You're seeing the kind of arguments that used to be made by the anti-war, liberal left and so on, now being taken up increasingly by the centre and by the moderate conservatives.
I thought it was very interesting that the French and Arab papers that you quoted earlier offered some rather familiar political analysis of the fallout from Richard Clark's book and the 9/11 Commission. I guess they're all looking ahead towards the election.
Yes, indeed. There was a remarkable editorial in my old newspaper, The Guardian, in Britain, which said, it's clear that Mr. Bush is now beatable and that Mr. Kerry is the best choice the Democrats could have made to beat him. American voters have done themselves a great favour. If they'd picked Howard Dean, Mr. Bush would have made mincemeat of him. The free world has never had a stronger interest in the result of an American election than it has in the defeat of George Bush. Senator Kerry carries the hopes not just of millions of Americans, but of millions of British well-wishers, not to mention those of nations throughout Europe and the world.
I think The Guardian represents a number of papers on the left. Closer to the center, or even towards the right of the spectrum, is the assessment of Kerry still the same?
Well, yes, indeed. Le Figaro, which is a conservative newspaper in France, had a rather witty editorial that said, "Do not say it too loudly. In fact, just whisper it among ourselves. But we think that John Kerry is a friend of France and probably a friend of Europe as well."
That may not help Kerry.
It might not, as the Russian paper Izvestia noted. Izvestia wrote that for most conservative Americans, the word European has become a term of abuse. Seen from the point of view of 100% red-blooded Americans, Kerry's background has a number of weaknesses. His wife is Portuguese. He spent his childhood in Norway, Germany, Switzerland, and France. How then could he possibly have avoided being afflicted by the spirit of European liberalism?
Martin, you've been reporting on European media for us for so long. Do you think they're taking a greater interest in the campaign for the American president earlier than they have before?
Oh, yes. I think most people think the stakes are that much higher, partly because of globalization, partly because of the highly emotional impact of the war, but also because President Bush, for most newspapers in the rest of the world, has a kind of a difficult track record. Even before the Iraq war broke out, don't forget, he was being widely criticized for his stands on global warming, on the Kyoto Protocol, the International Criminal Court, and so on. And as a result, there is a view that I see spread even among America's traditional friends and the centre-right press, that President Bush has really not been a particularly comfortable custodian of the free world that an American president traditionally has led.
Martin, thanks again.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the editor of UPI.
In January, prompted by an anonymous letter from a colleague, editors at USA Today launched an investigation into the work of star reporter Jack Kelly. Kelly resigned shortly thereafter, caught in a cover-up of his fabricated stories. Since then, USA Today has assigned 5 reporters, 1 editor, and a 3-member panel of former editors from outside the paper to scrutinize Kelly's work for embellishments, fabrications, and plagiarism. When the news of the Kelly investigation first broke, at this program there was a gasp followed by a shrug. The gasp, because I've known Jack for 22 years, and the resigned shrug because, okay, another reporter undone by his own hubris, another reason for the public to distrust the press. But as the details have started to emerge as to just what Kelly's lies amounted to, that shrug has turned into a shiver. John Gorenfeld is a contributing writer to Salon magazine, and he joins me now. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
There's a line from a Kelly article that you use to open your piece, and it begins with this couple of sentences. A Jewish settler named Avi Shapiro vows to eliminate the, quote, sons of Arab whores. He dons his yarmulke and, along with 12 vigilantes, riddles a Palestinian taxi with bullets. What became of that made-up story?
Well, there was a huge outcry from the Jewish community. They had their own suspicions at the beginning that it was a fabrication. They thought it was ridiculous that these very religious Jews would don their skull caps like they were putting on cowboy hats on the way out for a mission, when in reality, a very religious Orthodox Jew would probably have a skull cap on all the time. Likewise, there were people ranging from occupation critics to outright Nazi sympathizers who eagerly seized on the stereotype that Jack Kelly had drawn of this sinister, cold-blooded, Arab-hating Jewish settler, Avi Shapiro, from Brooklyn. And there were letter-writing campaigns. I found one by a Holocaust denial site, this extremist organization that wanted to make sure that its members congratulated Jack Kelly on his courage in breaking with the mainstream press and covering this evil being in a way that they felt was balanced.
By the same token, he wrote a similarly demonizing story about a young Pakistani boy, didn't he?
In this story, Jack Kelly claims that he met a group of young men who said, America, hear this, we will get your children, we will get their playgrounds. And at the end of the story, he has this incredible, improbable kicker. One of the students unrolls a photograph of the Sears Tower and says, this one's mine. After it ran in the paper, it really shows up everywhere, and it was cited twice by Tim Russert of Meet the Press. He ran it by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. He wanted to know, what does this say, basically, about the people that we're up against? There was even a Jonah Goldberg column in National Review Online saying, if we're dealing with people like this, then capturing their hearts and minds, he said, only makes sense if it means capturing them and putting them into mason jars.
These fictions are quite incendiary, and they have consequences in the real world.
One of the most interesting cases, and this is from a story that hasn't been fingered specifically yet by the USA Today investigation as untrue, although it's certainly questionable. Jack Kelly's eyewitness testimony entered upon a long-standing debate between Israelis and Palestinians over whether Palestinians were abusing Arab ambulances to fight back against Israeli soldiers. Now, Jack Kelly claims that he not only saw an Arab Red Crescent ambulance pull up and unload supplies for Molotov cocktails, he also says that he watched the driver get out and begin firing at Israeli soldiers before hopping back in his ambulance and driving off. And this eyewitness testimony from Jack Kelly has been quoted all over the place. There's even a quote from it on the website of the Israeli embassy. And a U.S. congressman followed up on it in condemning the Red Crescent. Now, for all we know, the story of Palestinians misusing ambulances may be entirely true. The trouble is, Jack Kelly's testimony is very pivotal in establishing this, and who knows how much effect it may have had on the Israeli policy of detaining ambulances on their way into areas like the West Bank.
One of the big questions swirling around the Jack Kelly scandal has been, it's so improbable that one reporter could be at the right place at the right time to run into all of this human drama. How could his fabrications not have been discovered by USA Today's editors long ere this? And in your piece, you get to one of the answers, and this is maybe one of the most troubling aspects of this whole story. It's because Kelly fundamentally was dealing in stereotypes.
I think there were stereotypes that people on both sides of the Mideast crisis and people in America during the build-up to the Afghanistan war were very eager to hear about. The most ironic part I found about this whole thing was that for so many people on both sides who ate up his caricatures of bloodthirsty Arabs and bloodthirsty Jews, in their minds, this was balanced journalism. It confirmed their pre-existing stereotypes of how wretched and inhuman the side that they didn't like was.
What does this episode tell you about the stakes of journalistic fraud?
I think this tells us that the stakes can be life or death. So far, much of the coverage I've seen of the Jack Kelly scandal has put the onus on his editors. It's very much been an inside baseball sort of look at what's wrong with journalistic editorial practices, almost a human resource issue. I think it's much more serious. It really gets at how people like this shape visions of reality, and it really, for me, defines the line between a kind of journalism that is really just going to not require people to think or question their assumptions and the kind that works in shades of gray and looks at ambiguities. I think Jack Kelly's fabrications certainly were designed not to change people's minds, but to reassure them of what they already felt about certain groups of people.
Well, John, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
John Gorenfeld is a contributing writer to Salon magazine.
Coming up, why it's too soon to trust the Iraqi press, another reason to distrust polls, and a trusted voice leaves his post.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
It's also On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the immediate aftermath of the toppling of Saddam Hussein, there was much excitement about the burgeoning media in Iraq, where once there were only state-run mouthpieces endlessly praising the glorious leader. Suddenly, ordinary Iraqis were offered hundreds of newspapers that ranged widely in focus and quality. With Ba'athist censorship lifted, journalists are free to practice their craft unimpeded. The only problem? They're not sure how. Hiwa Osman is an Iraqi Kurd working for the London-based Institute for War and Peace Reporting. His job has been to train Iraqi journalists. Hiwa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
How many newspapers and television channels are there now?
God, it's quite difficult to say because they pop up by the day, some of them. I can comfortably say there are over 150 newspapers today in just Baghdad. There are various TV channels, radio stations popping up. There's a huge quantity of media outlets, but the quality is suffering, I must say.
And that's part of your job right now, isn't it, to train Iraqi journalists in standard journalistic practice? And you wrote in the Washington Post that the main challenge is getting trainees to understand that neither they nor their opinions count.
Absolutely. See, the past 35 years or the Ba'ath era made every journalist believe that their role as a journalist is to contribute to the cause of, be it liberating Palestine, be it defending the borders of Iraq, and the various other causes that Saddam used to come up with every other day.
It wasn't really about gathering news, right? They weren't really reporting stories. What did they do?
Well, under Saddam, you could not gather any news. You were fed the news. I have this little story that I enjoyed telling. You know, Saddam or Iraq is not unique in this culture of feeding news to its journalists. Before the war, I was reporting for the BBC from Iraqi Kurdistan, and I ran across a Syrian journalist who was asking me to show him where the Ministry of Information was. I said, which Ministry of Information you're talking about? He said, well, where do I get my news? I said, which news? He said, well, the news that I'm supposed to be reporting back to my newspaper. I said, well, you just have to go to the street. It was quite a difficult concept for him. His job was to actually either rewrite or paraphrase some of the sentences that came from the government.
Obviously, the journalists need retraining, but what about the public? They must be entirely unaccustomed to trusting anything they read in the paper or hear in the media.
Absolutely, and it's part of the same problem. No newspaper has actually managed to or ever dared to criticize the regime. That's why people stopped buying newspapers, and they resorted to things that were said on the streets, from rumors, conspiracy theories. To this day, getting the public to buy newspapers is quite a difficult task. Iraqi public needs to see credibility before buying the newspapers.
Right now, there's a monumental effort to create democratic institutions in Iraq, and at least our founding fathers here in the U.S. felt you really couldn't have democratic institutions without a free and responsive press. Will the media be up to the task of fostering democracy?
Well, I think this is the chicken and egg argument that I have been having with many of my fellow Iraqis and fellow journalists. Some say it takes an election and a guarantor to hold another election to force journalists to impose a culture of free media and free press. Others say we need free press first and then democracy will follow. I think once we have the first election in Iraq with a guarantor that we will have a second election in 4 years' time, the elected representatives will be afraid of the media. This will create a sense of accountability, and the media will be forced to be up to the task of informing the public of what their elected officials are doing and of informing the elected officials what their public want from them.
Hiwa, it sounds like you have a big job ahead of you.
I think it's a tough one, and I'm enjoying every moment of it.
Hiwa Osman is an Iraqi Kurd working for the London-based Institute for War and Peace Reporting, but his job now is training journalists in Iraq. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Recent polls tell us that American media habits are changing, turning away from broadcast TV and newspapers to cable and the Internet. But how exactly do they know? Researchers at Ball State University set out to find how much media, including TV, radio, computers, books, even the telephone, their Indiana neighbors were consuming. But they were equally interested in testing one key methodology used by other pollsters, the phone interview. Telecommunications professor Bob Papper, who co-authored the Middletown Media Studies report, says his team followed up its own series of phone interviews by going a step further.
Indeed, we went two steps further. We did a diary study where we asked people to keep a log of their media use for a day. And we also did an observational study.
You had people in their homes?
In their homes from just after they woke up in the morning, as early as we could get there, until bedtime at night. We followed them to work. We followed them, in the car, to parties. Whatever they did, we were there.
And the ultimate discovery was that the respondents dramatically underreported in the telephone interviews and even in their diaries the amount of media that they were consuming.
Yeah. In fact, in the observational study, people used more than twice as much media as they said they did on the phone. 129.7% more media use per day than they reported to someone on the phone.
To what do you attribute the underreportage?
There is a body of research, mostly in much smaller studies, that says people have a lot of trouble telling you about their behavior. It's one thing for someone to answer, this is how I feel about something. It's entirely different when you ask someone, what did you do or not do? Now, the other factor I suspect that's involved is that we all know that there's certain media that's judged as good and other media that it may be judged as bad. And so there's some indications that we do a whole lot better job of estimating our time with what might be considered good media than we do with bad media.
People understand they're supposed to say they eat broccoli, not supposed to say they eat the junk food. On newspaper readership, people have been pretty accurate in their reporting?
Well, what they told us on the phone was very, very close to what we actually observed in practice. The worst medium as far as phone estimation is TV. It wasn't simply that people couldn't estimate how much time they spent with a medium. They weren't even very good at identifying whether they even used TV yesterday when they did.
In your conclusion, you observed that media usage is probably less than the sum of its parts. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that we found is that almost a quarter of the media day, people are using two or more media at the same time. And we think about multiple media use among kids, but this population were all adults. So while we found that the average person spent 11.7 hours a day in media, if we summed the individual media, we'd be at 15.4 hours a day.
Now, this has to be good news for the people in network television who have been observing what they have believed to be a steady erosion in their audience. Is this going to turn the advertising market upside down?
Advertisers are interested because they always want to know what are they buying and what are they getting. And we've got some very different news. And media companies are obviously interested because we're saying that a lot of the media measurement that we rely on isn't very accurate.
But what about the methodology of having people in the respondents' homes? Wouldn't that tend to skew the data as well by people being so aware of being observed that they find themselves gravitating to the use of media to help these nice folks who are doing the study?
Yeah, it may alter it. One researcher who reviewed this, however, suggested, you know, people may be doing a lot less media because they're so conscious of it and they're worried that they don't want to do too much. Margaret Mead inadvertently taught us that you cannot observe a population without altering its behavior at least some. As an example, no one in our population that we observed watched any pornography. Could be clean Midwestern living, but my guess is there's something else going on. I would still argue it's a considerably better measure of behavior than asking them on the phone.
If people's responses in telephone polls on the questions of their media consumption are skewed downward, it gets to a larger issue of how telephone polling is done on a whole range of subjects, including who do they intend to vote for in the presidential race.
You know, I suspect that one of the kind of dirty little secrets in research is that we always have known that there are problems in phone research, but it's so easy and it's so cheap that we keep doing it without ever testing, you know, how valid is this? And so, you know, we've really opened up that can of worms.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Bob Papper is a professor of telecommunications at Ball State University and co-author of the report titled Middletown Media Studies.
When you spin the radio dial, you know when you've hit National Public Radio. Its particular voice has been loved, derided, and parodied for years. This week, NPR announced that one of its signature voices will make way for a new one, yet to be determined. After 25 years hosting Morning Edition, Bob Edwards will leave his post on April 30th, but NPR says he'll stay on as a senior correspondent. Bob Edwards joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Bob, first of all, tell me what happened.
I think maybe I stayed too long. That's probably what happened. I don't feel I did, but maybe I'm not the best judge. One of the reactions to what's happened here has been very distressing to me, and that's been people saying, well, I'm never having anything to do with NPR anymore, and by golly, I'm not contributing to my local station, and I'm going to tell others to do it. That's wrong. That's wrong. You know, and it hurts me because I've spent 30 years trying to build this thing, and to have that undone, just because I've got a different job here, is I think the wrong way to go.
So tell me what NPR was like when you arrived there 30 years ago, and you were paired, I guess, briefly with Susan Stamberg at the then infant All Things Considered.
Well, I never lived in a dormitory or was part of a fraternity, but I'm told there are some parallels. We were very young. I was one of the senior people, and I was 26 years old. And that was exciting because we had young ideas. And since the network had no money to do more expensive things, we had to make it up every day. Everyone's imagination just is in overdrive. Well, let's do this. Well, I don't know. Should we try that? Can we get away with this? And with the result that when we failed, it was a whopper. But when something, you know, new and exciting and bold was out there, it made an impression.
And so now I think everybody says the network sounds consistently better. The reporting is consistently of higher quality. There are certainly fewer valleys, but also fewer peaks.
That's true. And that has to be conceded, that yes, we don't take the risks we did then because, one, we don't have to.
Now, you're leaving Morning Edition is probably the most important staff change the network has ever had. And what do you think this portends about changes at NPR, the evolution, perhaps, of NPR?
Well, I don't know. This is where I'm flummoxed. I'm torn here. I want to be part of the future. But if I wasn't part of the future as the host of Morning Edition, what is that future and how can I be part of it? So I'm asking all those questions, and I hope to serve.
Did they tell you over the years that perhaps there was too much predictability at Morning Edition, that the sound that has been such a signature sound for NPR had become almost too soothing, too relaxed?
Not in so many words, but now to say that, you know, if they had told me that, that makes perfect sense, that people are bored with it or something, but the number of listeners wouldn't reflect that. Maybe they feel that even though we've doubled the audience in the last 10 years, it could have been tripled, quadrupled, and maybe it will yet. I hope so, if that's the case. And if I can make that happen by going away, hey, I'll take the hit.
Is there something you think you might have done differently?
No, because I think we are who we are. You find your voice. You know, Red Barber and I used to talk about this all the time. When he was a kid, starting out in broadcasting, he wanted to be Graham McNamee, who was the great legend of earliest radio. And he was trying to imitate him on the air until his station manager took him by the lapels and said, no, we already have a Graham McNamee. Let's hear Red Barber. And you have to be yourself on the radio because people spot a phony immediately. You have to find your own voice. But when you're a kid, you don't know who you are. Well, I did the same thing with Merle, because I didn't know. I didn't know who I was, so I was trying to be Merle. That's what I grew up hearing. And ultimately, I found out who I was. Well, who I am is still who I am. I can't change, because it wouldn't be me. You see what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think we could probably describe in a few well-chosen adjectives who Murrow was and what he sounded like. Do you think you have the distance to do that for yourself? How would you describe your presence on the air?
One word would certainly be minimalist. I don't chatter on except when people like you are interviewing me. Because when I'm doing an interview, the star of the interview is the person I'm interviewing, not me. So my questions are short, direct, to the point. My best questions are, oh, no, really? Because this is a signal to the guests that where you're going is great. Keep going there. I try to be an engaging interviewer, a soft-spoken interviewer. I can't do that district attorney third-degree thing very well.
Sandra Singh Low, who got bumped off of KCRW for an unbleeped expletive and then was asked back, although she declined to come, said in a Marketplace commentary that public radio had become increasingly bland, vanilla, beige. What do you think about that assessment?
I don't hear beige. I don't hear bland. No, I hear exciting things on public radio. I like Morning Edition. Why wouldn't I, right? I like All Things Considered and the way it sounds. I like your program. Sound Print, Tavis, Car Talk, Prairie Home Companion. I love what's going on here.
Management has said that this is not about demographics. It's not about, for instance, attracting a younger audience, but about listener needs. Do you know what that means?
Listener needs. So that I don't have what listeners need? Well, that would be a blow, wouldn't it? That would be a blow. I don't know. I go out every month to a member station and help them with fundraising and get to know listeners. And I've always loved the idea of meeting listeners and talking to the audience and finding out what's on their mind. So I don't feel I've been sheltered from the listeners or that they've been shy about expressing their needs because they give me an earful and I bring it back here.
Getting up at midnight or earlier every weekday for 25 years, that can be a strain. Are you saying that you were never tired of what you were doing, Bob?
Maybe I sounded it, and maybe that's a good reason to move, you know? Maybe I'm not functioning on every cylinder that I can if I'm getting a full night's sleep. Maybe I'll be better. Lots better.
Bob, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
On April 30th, Bob Edwards will conclude his long run at the helm of NPR's Morning Edition.
Coming up, why American products succeed overseas while America, the product, fails.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. Listener Mike Jackson said our interview with NPR's John Burnett on his experience as an embedded reporter in Iraq is, quote, yet another example of one-sided reporting. The impression this report gives is that somehow the government is responsible for duping the public by allowing reporters embedded access to the military during the war. If there's any blame to be laid, it should be laid at the feet of the media organizations. If the media chose only to report the stories from their embedded reporters, then they were doing the public a disservice by not giving them a complete picture.
Bill Salmon wrote with the opinion that, quote, the reporting provided by embedded reporters was effective, and I do not think that they were duped. It was effective in showing the effect of policy on the individuals who were obliged to implement it. The problems are more with the population, their representatives, and their interpretation of the reportage.
Listening to our discussion a few weeks back about reality TV's Sisters with Attitude, Robin Hiltz of Ashland, New Hampshire, objected to some words that were bandied about, including one word that rhymes with witch. I frequently listen to your show as part of my NPR listening routine with my 5-year-old son nearby. I encourage my son to ask questions about what he hears and was not planning on having to explain such adult language to him. Please be aware that your audience is not a late-night commercial TV audience.
Sally and Tom Campbell of Fort Worth, Texas, wrote in to say that we left an attractive option out of our discussion about the fight between Viacom and the Dish Network that briefly deprived many viewers of CBS. Quote, we get our feed from a television set, they wrote. It costs about $150. After the purchase, you spend nothing until the PBS pledge guilt gets you. Granted, we get only about 15 channels. Often there's nothing worth watching. So what? We've got a radio that gets NPR, PRI, a jazz station, and R&B oldie station, numerous Latin stations, etc. We have a nice big main library, too.
Well, Sally and Tom, thanks for squeezing us into your busy media schedule. And thanks for the letter, too. Keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live, as well as how to pronounce your name.
When she left her post a year ago citing failing health, former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy Charlotte Beers was reluctant to speak of her experience in the battle for Muslim hearts and minds. Hers was a trying 17-month tenure marked by bureaucratic obstacles, false starts, and in some cases, public ridicule. Now, with a year's reflection, the former advertising executive spoke with us about her experience, beginning with showing up for her new job shortly after September 11th to discover a propaganda apparatus all but entirely dismantled since the end of the Cold War.
It was simply shocking how little equipment we had, had we agreed on a message to get the word out. And there was a complete dearth of training. The State Department has really mastered what we would call traditional diplomacy, but I call it private because it's with government and it's discreet, it's even secretive, it's necessarily intimate. And anathema to them would be to go public, you know, to talk to the peoples of these countries.
Isn't one of the fundamental problems here that the State Department has been talking to these regimes at the highest levels, and that these regimes are sometimes authoritarian and repressive and as much a part of the problem as part of the solution?
The governments don't actually know very much about what their people are thinking and feeling. They went to school in the United States, and all their friends are sophisticated about the United States, and they don't understand how serious the myth, the biases, the misinformation that exists and travels throughout these countries. A gentleman once said to me when I explained that we would like to present our culture, he said, "Madam, we are drowning in it." He meant the kind of television that I use probably unfairly, Baywatch, because I've never even seen it. Certain kinds of music and references, these are part of our culture. But the problem is they're not a total picture.
Over the last couple of years, we've kind of saved string on the public diplomacy story. We reported on the original campaign that appeared in some countries in the Middle East.
Yeah, that was a series of documentaries about Muslims who practiced their religion in the United States at a time of high religious concentration in the Middle East called Ramadan. And it was one of a five-point program that was intended to create a recognition that we respect that religion as we do all others. And it's interesting because where it got the whole program with the follow-up research, with the visits from the Muslim families who were in the documentaries going to these countries and speaking, we had exceptionally positive response. And they revealed the degree of their distortions. I mean, the women would say one after another, "I had no idea you could wear your scarf in the United States."
On the other hand, there was a lot of criticism from the Middle East and elsewhere that this was just an attempt to use slick advertising techniques to gloss over the fundamental policy problems that make Muslims suspicious of the United States' motives wherever it operates around the world.
Well, where this program ran in its entirety, the data is very clear. People not only were interested that it was mind-opening, almost always they came back and said, "Tell me more."
But it is axiomatic that there's nothing that kills a bad product better than good advertising.
That's absolutely true.
The theory is that once you call attention to the product and get people to sample it, if they don't like it, you're finished with them. In trying to create a dialogue with people who were fundamentally distrustful of the United States, was there not the risk of exactly this kind of backlash given United States policy with respect to Israel and the Palestinians, for example, or given the fact that the United States was invading Iraq? Was there a chance that the very existence of the public diplomacy efforts were only going to harden opposition to everything that America stands for?
You know, Bob, I'm glad you've asked this because this is a question that is actually very frightening to me. Nothing would be more dangerous than silence. It's like asking Tylenol to be very quiet when people found out there was poison inadvertently put into their Tylenol packages. They went immediately to the air in every phase of communication to talk about what they were going to do, how it would be handled, and they won a huge round with the consumer groups. We do have some policies that are not popular, and that doesn't mean necessarily that we can make those policies popular, but we can certainly engage on many other fronts.
notwithstanding the resistance to American foreign policy, there is an ever-eager audience for our brands, for Coca-Cola and Walt Disney and Baywatch, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
Did you use that as a point of departure in your work, the idea that just because something was exported from America did not necessarily mean that it was regarded as unsavory in Muslim and Middle Eastern countries?
The skill it takes to have a brand cross borders is to create a universal understanding, you know, maybe the love of a Coke and the party that goes with it and so on. And the second thing was to always honor and respect the local customs. And so the lessons that we all had to learn as marketers to earn the right to sell our brands in those countries is one the United States has to practice. I mean, the first thing I did in the first year was bring in people from the private sector to conduct courses in that kind of communication, which is about context and also about the basics of branding, really.
Well, Charlotte, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Charlotte Beers, former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, spoke to us from her home in Charleston, South Carolina. In a March poll by the Pew Center for People and the Press, 62% of Frenchmen declared disapproval of the United States. So did 93% of Jordanians and 34% of Britons. Anybody who still asks, why do they hate us, just isn't paying attention. And anybody who replies, they hate our freedoms, isn't looking at the data. 70% of Germans, according to the Pew poll, are less confident that the U.S. wishes to promote democracy. 66% of Turks believe U.S. leaders lied about the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. 63% of Moroccans believe America's motives are to control Mideast oil. So the question is, if the great Satan is so damned unpopular, why exactly are the Golden Arches going gangbusters? McDonald's grew 6.5% in Europe, Asia, and Africa in each of the past 2 months. Coca-Cola is growing. Jack Daniels and MTV are growing. Marlboro, in spite of worldwide anti-tobacco legislation, is growing. It would seem to be a paradox. American products embraced and beloved, while America the product is met with contempt. In spearheading his magazine's annual brand survey, Business Week senior editor Jerry Kermush expected to see a backlash of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the war on Iraq against America's commercial icons. What he found instead was ambivalence writ large.
We had bureau reporters in places like India who'd seen examples of people demonstrating against America, burning American flags in front of the embassy for the TV cameras. And once it was all over, they went down the street to McDonald's and had lunch.
Look at the Palestinians throwing rocks against Israelis. The way they are dressed, jeans, and often T-shirts that have Disney characters on their chests.
Ahmed Ali Abougait is permanent representative to the United Nations from Egypt, where consumers have no difficulty compartmentalizing the American lifestyle they envy and the American politics they despise.
Yes, they objected to the war in Iraq. However, they maintained their liking to whatever that is still American, from McDonald's to Pizza Hut to American cars to American music, American films.
No, that wasn't Dick Cheney. It was Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic, one of the most successful American exports of all time, raking in more than $1.2 billion in box office overseas. After the invasion of Iraq, Hollywood braced for a collision with an iceberg of anti-Americanism, because not only is Hollywood quintessentially American, it is also notoriously the vector for our alleged decadence, spiritual emptiness, and moral depravity. But the catastrophic collision of foreign cultures and U.S. pop culture never came.
Actually, the box office abroad has held up extremely well. In fact, it seems to be on the increase.
Elizabeth Guider is deputy editor of Variety magazine.
Anywhere from 60 to 80% of the entire box office, say, in Italy, is American movies, not Italian movies. In Indonesia, the most popular shows at the moment are Fear Factor and Survivor.
So, yeah, Fear Factor is very well received. This wasn't.
My name is Farouk Muhammad. I'm a paramedic for the Fire Department of New York. I have co-workers who are Jewish, who are Christian, Catholic, Hindu even, all different faiths.
Though the State Department insists the campaign's message of America as a hospitable environment for Muslims jimmied open doors of understanding, it was widely ridiculed in the Arab press and quickly pulled off the air. But is it really evidence of that mysterious paradox, or is it just a question of overestimating the power of advertising? Keith Reinhardt is chairman of the ad agency DDB Worldwide.
No amount of advertising would ever be able to sell a product which hasn't been carefully designed for the intended audience. The first step is listening very carefully through all the research we can gather so that we know what it is about the product we should promote, what it is we should change, and how we should conduct ourselves. We should certainly never start with the advertising step.
After all, for all the glitzy ad campaigns, nobody ever bought the Edsel, the Newton, or Touch of Yogurt shampoo. At the moment, rightly or wrongly, American foreign policy is an Edsel. And neither a series of State Department videos nor such American-produced media as Radio Sawa are going to change that. American business has taken note of the government's failure to win hearts and minds and is taking it upon itself to revitalize brand America its own way. Ad exec Keith Reinhardt also heads the Business for Diplomatic Action initiative.
It's about action. U.S. business could organize a collective intern program. Once young people come and actually live here, they are changed forever as they go back to their home states. Listening programs, youths listening to one another online, possibly in a McDonald's or a Starbucks. The idea of Americans listening to the world.
MTV, for one, is listening. The Viacom cable network has created 94 music channels around the world in the image of the local cultures. A colorful, comical Bollywood take in India, high-tech everything in Japan, and in Indonesia, five times daily, a call to prayer. And at least one successful world marketer invites locals to bow before another almighty, dangling the rags-to-riches promise of American prosperity.
Michael Norris is Vice President of Global Marketing for Alticor, parent company of Amway.
If we are listening to the reports on Iraq, you know, the one frustration is that they want to see the American magic come to them. They want to see their quality of life improving. They want to grow. They want to be better. And it all boils down to opportunity, you know, and that's what America has.
You can fragment the American brand experience into a thousand pieces, but the fundamental basis of it would have to do with the rule of law, the belief in freedom, the opportunities for the individual.
Charlotte Beers, for all her difficulties in her brief tenure as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, also still believes the greatest opportunity is to mine that core for the hope it still represents.
America is one of the most complex and fascinating brands I've ever met.
Some bridle at the very notion of America, the brand, as if reducing our nation's ideals to something so crass as product attributes insults the very dignity of our democracy. But a brand, by definition, is not an accumulation of hype. It is the accumulation of core values and benefits, both intrinsic and perceived. The challenge facing the State Department and the nation at large is to persuade a skeptical world that brand America is new and improved. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Rob Christensen and Jennifer Munson are engineers. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.